You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Daniel Kahneman's latest book, Thinking Fast and Slow, explores the two major systems the mind uses to evaluate possibilities and make choices, and why often the most obvious answers turn out to be incorrect. Mr. Kahneman, who is Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, examines underlying assumptions and illusions that impede our ability to recognize reality in this book, which is published by Ferrer, Straus, and Giroux, and I'm very pleased, I think, that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
I'm quite sure I'm pleased to be here.
Although you are a research psychologist, you received a Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002. Has that kind of cross-discipline prize ever been awarded before?
I'm not sure that I believe I may be the first psychologist to have gotten a prize in economics.
That's because they don't have a prize in psychology?
There is no prize in psychology.
Well, how is your work relevant to economics?
Well, you know, economic theory is based on some assumptions about human agents and what makes them tick and what they do. And there are three basic assumptions: that people are rational, that they're selfish, and that their tastes do not change. And, you know, psychologists don't believe that. The work we did, Amos Tversky and I, convinced some economists that those common assumptions should be questioned.
And more recently, we've been hearing that we should go with our gut impulse. Malcolm Gladwell would blink, for example. You're not so happy with that either. So we're caught in the middle, aren't we?
Well, we're caught with the human nature we have. I mean, we'd better accept it.
Well, how did you get interested in this particular subject? Did you specifically set out to explore your ideas in terms of economics, or did other practitioners apply them to that discipline?
Oh, we had no intention of influencing economics at all. What happened was that Richard Thaler, who is now the guru of behavioral economics and was then, you know, a young heretic, I would say, among economists, he became interested in our work. And it's really through him that the influence in economics took place.
You said that your research was done with Amos Tversky. What was the first project you worked on together?
Our first project was a study of the statistical intuitions of statistical experts, which turned out not to be very good.
So people who think they know a lot about statistics usually guess wrong, but do they correct themselves once they look at the statistics, or do they just keep on working on their faulty assumptions?
What motivated us was that many people keep working on their faulty assumption. They never realize that they're making a mistake. The big mistake that motivated that work was the discovery that psychologists who run experiments with samples that are much too small. And if the samples are small, your chances of finding the truth are reduced, and yet people persist in doing that.
As Noam Chomsky pointed out, children have an innate sense of grammar. Do they also have an innate sense of statistics?
I believe not. Really, intuitively, we're quite poor at statistics. We're good at storytelling, which is very different from statistical reasoning.
You've been accused of studying people's stupidity. Do you accept that?
I never accepted that, because actually the work that Amos Tversky and I was doing, you know, our main research method was to invent questions that fooled us, or that we were tempted to give the wrong answer to. So, and
you,
we
you
never
tested
thought
your
we were
assumptions.
Stupid.
You tested your assumptions on yourself.
Absolutely.
And you discovered that there is an irrational streak in us all.
Well, you know, it's not an irrational streak. It's just that we think associatively, we think intuitively, and that thinking doesn't fit the requirements of, you know, how economists define rationality.
So what is the available heuristic, the speculative formulation that we use?
Well, there are many heuristics. In general, what happens intuitively is that when you're faced with a difficult question, you answer an easier one. And that happens without your knowing that you're answering the wrong question. So there are many heuristics that have many names, but that's the general theme.
Well, can you give me an example of how that works? You cite Mayor Bloomberg's small school fallacy. Is that a good example?
Well, that's a complicated example because that involves statistical reasoning. But I can give you a simple example. There was a survey done among students with two questions. One was, how happy are you? And the other one was, how many dates did you have last month? And the question was, what are the correlation between the answers to these two questions? Now, in the order that I gave, happy, dates, there's no correlation. You invert the order. So you first ask people, how many dates did you have last month? And then, how happy are you? The correlation is very high. So clearly, when they're asked the difficult question of how happy are you, they already have an answer in their mind, which is how satisfied they are with their dating. And that dominates their answer.
Well, it's been pointed out often that the way a pollster asks questions on any issue can influence the answers that we get. So this can happen with questions about whether people are happy with the members of Congress who are representing them or the economic situation at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, and it's not only the public. Physicians have respond differently to statistical evidence on medicine, depending on whether the same results are described in terms of mortality or in terms of survival.
So how did you devise these experiments?
Well, you know, Amos and I, we would spend a lot of time together, and we would just invent puzzles that, where we were tempted to, we knew the right answer, but we were tempted to give the wrong one. And that's how we invented them.
But you even have some things here, like depending on how you hold a pencil in your mouth, you're going to have a different response to things.
Well, that is a much more recent discovery. I mean, the book that I wrote actually attempts to evaluate the early work that we did, or reinterpret it to some extent, in the light of the new evidence. It turns out that we tend to generate very coherent responses to things that happen, and that coherent in terms of the physical reaction as well as the mental and emotional reaction. When you put the pencil lengthwise into your mouth, it shapes your mouth into the shape of a smile. And when you, and people don't know it, but they find cartoons funnier when it's that way, you stick the pencil in your mouth in the other direction, it makes you frown, and then the world looks worse.
But some of these things are really scary. You have examples where a judge is exposed to certain numbers and then goes in to sentence somebody and winds up sentencing the person to years, depending on the numbers that he had discussed earlier. Come up playing dice.
That is a truly frightening experiment, and it's not the only one about judges. But in that case, there were German judges, and it was a mock trial of, I think, a shoplifter. Some of them were asked, would you sentence this person to 9 months or more? And the others were asked, would you sentence this person to 3 months or more? And those who were asked about 9 months said 8 months. Those who were asked about 3 months said 5 months. You, by raising a question, by considering something as a possibility, you're shaping your mind so that anything that you consider becomes more plausible. This is the way we understand things.
My guest is Daniel Kahneman, K-A-H-N-E-M-A-N. His latest book, Thinking Fast and Slow, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Is this book written for the layperson?
Yes. Definitely.
Will it help us recognize the flaws in our own decision-making process and therefore help us make better choices?
I don't make that claim. I really don't believe in self-help. This work is intended for gossipers, for people who look at the decisions of others and want to criticize them intelligently. So I want to educate gossip.
Because the nature of these foibles are so invisible in us that it's almost impossible for us to know that we're engaging in them.
Oh, certainly. I mean, when we make mistakes, we are so busy making them that we have nothing left to observe ourselves.
We've seen similar things with people in psychoanalysis who understand all of the various mechanisms of their neuroses and yet continue to do similar things.
Well, yes. I mean, there is knowing that you are prone to biases by itself does absolutely nothing for you.
So let's talk about some of the things that you discuss here. Machinery of the mind. Can you describe the two systems we use to make choices?
Well, I can give a sense of what they are. You know, describing them takes many pages in the book. But one mode of thinking is what happens when I ask you, you know, 2 plus 2. Now, the number 4 came to your mind. If I say 17 times 24, you know, you recognize it's a multiplication problem, but no solution came to your mind. And if you had to generate it in your head, you would have to go through a complicated program, a series of operations. It would load your memory. Your pupils would dilate. Your heart rate would increase. And so system one is effortless and automatic. That's the one that generates 2 plus 2. System two is more laborious.
But you also can complicate these situations. You have a chart, for example, or a couple of charts, one with the words left and right and another with the words capitals and lowercase. Or is it uppercase and lowercase? And if uppercase is written in lowercase, we have to spend a moment in determining whether it's lowercase or uppercase, even though we know it's lowercase.
Well, you know, I mean, even though we know, you want to say two things that are contradictory. The classic example, actually, is when people are shown a set of colors, patches of color, and they are asked to name the colors. Now, the patches of colors, if they are words, then people will do just fine naming the colors, except if the word red appears colored green, people will want to say red, and they are very likely to make a mistake. Reading
Jasper Johns
is automatic.
Played with that in a whole bunch of paintings.
Well, you know, this conflict between what you want to say and what you should say is something that people feel.
Now, how much of this is based on gut reaction?
How much of what is
well,
based on
I mean,
gut reaction?
Because what happens there is this immediate response. It's almost like a gut reaction.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we call gut reaction is what I call system one thinking. So it is the thinking that is automatic and that is fast. So that's the fast thinking.
That's what Malcolm Gladwell was talking about in his book, Blink?
Yes.
Do you go along with all of the ideas in that book?
Well, you know, Malcolm Gladwell actually, in his book, discussed cases in which blinks don't work and in which intuitions are poor. But most readers were much more impressed by the magic of intuition than by the deficiencies of intuition, and he did not take a position. In the book, I made a real effort to try to describe to people when you can trust intuitions and when you shouldn't.
So what kinds of situations lend themselves to an intuitive response?
Well, in general, you'll do very well in intuitive response and with intuitive responses if you've had a lot of practice. And if you've had a lot of feedback on whether you're right or wrong, so all of us, I think, can recognize our spouse's mood, you know, by one word on the phone, and physicians can recognize some people who are ill. They can recognize and diagnose in one look. So that's expertise.
Well, I remember Arthur Koestler writing about the two ways that archers might work. The Western way, whereas you take the bow and arrow and you aim it at the target, and the Eastern way, where you just get to the right moment and you let the arrow go. People were arguing whether one was better than the other, and his point was, well, both of them come from a lot of practice, and it winds up being the same thing, even though we'd like to believe one is better than the other.
Well, you know, the way I would formulate it is that the chances that practice will make you good depends on the environment that you live in being regular enough so that there is a structure to it and you can learn what works and what doesn't. So, you know, it works for chess players. It doesn't work for political pundits.
Daniel Kahneman is Eugene Higgins Professor of Psychology Emeritus at Princeton University and Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs Emeritus at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He won the Nobel Prize in 2002 in Economic Sciences. His latest book is called Thinking Fast and Slow. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, K-A-H-N-E-M-A-N. His latest book, Thinking Fast and Slow, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Why do you say that when people are challenged by a demanding cognitive task, they're more prone to yield to temptations?
Well, it turns out that we have a limited capacity to allocate attention, and self-control demands attention. And so if we are busy cognitively, if we're holding numbers in our head or performing a multiplication task, our self-control is actually depleted.
Do physical, mental, and emotional tasks all draw from the same pool of mental energy?
Indeed they do, and this is very surprising. So, you know, if you have someone who is uncomfortable with members of another race and you put them in one room and they have to talk with each other for 20 minutes, and then you give the more bigoted individual a hand grip, something that measures that he has to hold, and hand grip is weakened by having made the effort to stay polite for 20 minutes. So, yes, indeed, the evidence is that all of this draws on a single resource.
Does this, the system two, which we're just discussing, does it monitor the suggestions of system one?
Oh, certainly. I mean, you know, we don't say everything that comes to mind, and, you know, we don't yield to every impulse.
The bigot is not going to make bigoted remarks, even though they may be rushing through his brain.
Well, no, for example, but we know that if I ask you to hold seven digits in your head, and then I give you other things, but you know that later you'll be tested on the seven digits, you're more likely to use sexist language. So, you know, that's been shown in an experiment.
Really? Sexist language? Why?
Because normally we suppress sexist language. And anything that we suppress tends to come out when we're cognitively busy.
I thought that only happened when you drink too much.
When you drink too much, the same thing happens. When you drink too much, your self-control is impaired.
What is the associatively coherent? How does that work?
Well, the way it works is that when we see something, we generate a story. That is something, you know, system one generates a story. This is the way that the associative machinery works, is that it generates an interpretation. And in general, it generates a coherent interpretation. So, you know, to give you an example, I discuss in the book a bit. The word bank means something in the context. For most people who are city dwellers, it will mean a place with vaults and money. The word bank in another context means the bank of a river. Mm-hmm. But we are not conscious of the ambiguity. That is, you know, some people, the same person will interpret it one way in one context and another way in another context without being aware that there are actually two interpretations.
Can you describe the Florida effect?
Sure. The Florida effect is a classic study that really started a whole movement in psychological research. So students were asked, as I recall, to construct sentences from lists of words. And in one of the conditions, the words included things like Florida and wrinkles words, in short, that are social security, maybe words, in short, that are associated with old age. Then the students who participated in that were asked to go to another experiment, and there was a long corridor, and the point of the experiment was to measure the speed with which they reached their destination. And after being, as we say, primed for old age, students walked more slowly.
You actually had planted the seeds of feeling elderly in their minds.
Absolutely.
And did that happen in every case? No. There are some people who just walk fast no matter what. No. Their elderly often walk fast.
Well, what you do, of course, in those experiments is that you have two groups, and they're randomly chosen, so they're presumably identical, or at least very similar. One group gets that treatment, and the other group makes up a sentence that's not associated with old age.
How do reminders of money produce some troubling effects on participants in experiments?
Well, that is a truly astonishing set of results, a series of studies in which peripheral stimuli that people are sometimes not even conscious of really have a substantial effect on their behavior in many aspects. So to give you an example, you have young people, you know, that come to an experiment and they are working on one computer, but the computer next to them has a screensaver. And if the screensaver has dollar bills floating in money, their behavior is affected in pretty profound ways.
Are they looking over at the other computer?
You know, it just happens. You register it. So you register it in the periphery of vision. You're not even aware of anything in particular. But it tends to make you more independent. That is, it makes you more reluctant to ask questions. And it tends to make you more selfish. You are less likely to help other people. It makes you distant from other people. So that if you have to set two chairs for a conversation, you set them further apart if you have seen money than not.
And then if you add other things into the equation, like reminding them of their mortality?
Well, reminding people of their mortality has profound effects. All of this is research that I haven't done, but it's research of
the last
years.
But it's all in the same area.
It turns out that it is quite important to understanding the research on intuition and on mistakes of intuition. You remind people of their mortality, they become authoritarian, much more authoritarian. Among many other things.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's the theory. Again, it's not my theory, and I'm not even an expert on that area, but the theory is called terror management. That is, the existential fear associated with death makes people seek reassurance, and they seek reassurance in flags and in symbols of authority and... That's the way it goes.
And should we assume that somebody who is driven to become the dictator of a country is often worrying about his own mortality?
Well, no. It makes people want to be followers, not necessarily leaders.
My guest is Daniel Kahneman. His book, Thinking Fast and Slow, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You even talk about how the typeface of something that something is written in influences our sense of its credibility.
Oh yes, I mean in general, there is what is called an illusion of truth. That is, you present people with statements and you even tell them that they're false, and the question later you test them on whether they believe the statement is true or false. And it turns out you are going to believe the truth of a statement more if it was printed very clearly and in bold letters.
This is why Helvetica is such a popular typeface, because it looks establishment?
I haven't thought about this particular question, but the font certainly makes a difference. Certain things, you know, look truer, more assertive than anything that is asserted and is familiar and easily recognizable will feel true.
What is our capacity for surprise say about our mental life?
It says that our associative memory is an astonishing device in terms of the subtlety of it. So, you know, my favorite example is a study in which people heard a sentence. They heard many sentences, but one of them was spoken by an upper-class British male voice. And it said, "I have large tattoos all down my back." And within about 3/10 of a second, the brain reacts in a characteristic signature of surprise. And if you think about it, it's astonishing because you have to know to recognize that voice is upper-class British. You have to recognize that upper-class males probably don't have tattoos on their back. So the combination is incongruous, and people detect that immediately. That takes a very powerful device.
On the other hand, if somebody said it with a different kind of accent, we would be spending less time or energy on it?
Well, certainly. I mean, you would not... You know, there is no incongruity. Most of the time what happens to us is normal. And then we just let it go.
But then there are all sorts of other incongruities. When we ask a question like, how many animals of each kind did Moses take into the ark? What can we expect people to answer?
Well, they will certainly accept that question and try to figure out if pairs are the correct number. But in fact, they won't respond. They won't realize that it was Noah, mm-hmm. not Moses, who took animals from the ark.
So why are we so slow to recognize that error?
Well, it's because we understand anything in terms of the context in which it is. So Moses is a biblical, the context of the Bible, and that works for Moses and it works for the Ark. You know, if you had put George W. Bush instead of Moses in that, it would be a joke.
But it's also, there's a certain distraction quality here. If we focus people on the thing that they want to answer or that they're most interested in trying to figure out, then they ignore the other part of the question, don't they?
Well, yes. I mean, that of course, happens a lot.
How did the Belgian psychologist Albert Michaud, is it Michaud?
Yes, it is.
Change the way that we think about causality?
Well, you know, there was a history of thinking about causality in statistical terms as a connection between two events that appear regularly in the sequence. Michaud showed that causality is something else, because he showed that, two drawings on a piece of, which are clearly drawings on a two-dimensional surface, when they move in a particular way so that one of them touches the other and then the other starts moving, we perceive that as one of them launching the other or causing the other to move. So causality is innately perceived, and it's not a statistical inference.
I mentioned earlier the Bloomberg administration's claim that small schools perform better than large schools based on statistics, and you said that was flawed. We have a few moments. Can you get into that? Right now, Mayor Bloomberg is going through all sorts of problems. A lot of people are very angry with him. Maybe we can make them a little angrier.
Well, we shouldn't make them angrier, but what we do know is that small schools are more variable than large schools, because small samples are a lot more variable than large samples. So if you compare extreme results, you are going to find that the extreme, the very best schools, are likely to be small. You'll also find, by the way, that the very worst schools are likely to be small. But if we focus on what makes schools extreme, we're going to land with that conclusion that small schools are better.
Well, we start off with the conventional wisdom that fewer students in a class automatically will lead to better education.
Well, I think that there is a statistician, Howard Weiner, and now I block on the name of the book that he has written, who has discussed these issues truly eloquently and shown the error of these conclusions.
Early in your career, you realized that the way you graded your students' essay exams was unfair.
Well, yes, because the way that I was doing it initially was, if there were four essays, I would take the booklet and read the four essays of one student. This is the wrong way to grade essays. You should take the first essay and go through all the notebooks, and you should do something else as a precaution. You should put your grade for that first question on the back of the booklet so that you won't see it when you come to grade the second question. Otherwise, you will be influenced by it, and that is unfair.
Do people somehow feel demeaned by just evaluating the statistically important elements of a situation?
I don't think that people necessarily feel demeaned, but it is true that we are much more satisfied by stories than we are by statistical evidence. And stories and specific cases have much greater power on our imagination than statistics do.
You were once lecturing a group of flight instructors in the Israeli Air Force about the effectiveness of rewards as opposed to punishments, and one instructor disagreed with you.
Well, yes. I mean, I was telling them that statistical research has shown that reward works better than punishment. And he told me, well, that may be true for the birds, but it's not true for my cadets. And then he went on to say, when I praise somebody for doing some flight maneuvers very well, the next time they try it, they're likely to be worse. And when I scream at them for bad performance, the next time they're likely to be better. Now, this turns out to be a recognizable statistical phenomenon called regression to the mean. If you did absolutely nothing, when you look at extremely good performance, it's more likely to deteriorate the next time.
Well, the coaches all understand that, don't they?
Coaches learn a great deal of statistics intuitively, and when you talk to them about it, they may not know the statistics, but they certainly acquire statistical knowledge.
Well, there are some other statistics that confuse me. Is it true that highly intelligent women tend to marry men who are less intelligent than they are?
Yes, it is, but that doesn't mean that there is any causal connection. It is true in all these cases that if you select an extreme group, be it extremely good schools or extremely intelligent women, and then you look at some other thing that is imperfectly correlated with it, you'll find regression to the mean.
But how does that work the other way around? Highly intelligent men, are they looking for less intelligent women?
Well, highly intelligent men.
Aren't they looking for their equals?
Well,
if they're really smart?
It's not actually what you're looking for. It's just if I tell you that the intelligence of husbands and wives is not perfectly correlated, then regression is inevitable.
Will depressed children treated with an energy drink show improvement over a 3-month period?
Oh, they certainly will. But that is, again, regression to the mean, because depressed children are an extreme group. And if you test them again, they are likely to be less extreme.
So we get all of these things in the newspapers. Studies indicate this, that, or the other thing. Should we be suspicious because of what you're saying now?
Well, what you want to know, certainly there are mistakes that make their way. There are mistakes that professionals make, and there are mistakes that make their ways into the press. We should always ask about sample results, how large the sample was. We should ask whether it was truly randomly selected. The public is not suspicious enough of the statistics that are presented.
There were an awful lot of other things I wanted to get to, planning fallacies and the psychological utility of units of money, loss aversion, but we've run out of time. I guess I'm going to have to recommend this book to my listeners. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow, written by Daniel Kahneman, who is the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure.